This is Mark Steiner. We are in Washington, D.C. today at our sister studios, Clean Cuts Music and Sound. And we're here with Temple Grandin, her latest book, The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. And Temple Grandin, of course, many people know who she is from the HBO movie, but the work she's done as professor of animal science at Colorado State.
Colorado State.
Did I say Cal?
Yeah, no, it's Colorado State University.
So and each book kind of builds on the next, and this book is very different, I think, than the other stuff you've written in some ways, because it's really, really addressing the autistic people and what we should be looking for and the advances. And because this, the way you started thinking about back in the 1940s when they first used the diagnosis.
Well, they thought that it was all psychological. See, the thing is, autism diagnosis is a behavioral profile. It's not precise like having something like tuberculosis. And it can vary from brilliant Silicon Valley people out there doing computers.
Uh-huh.
And the radio stations probably would not exist at all if you didn't have people on the spectrum to invent them in the first place. And so at one end of the spectrum, you've got someone who's really smart but socially awkward and maybe good at one kind of skill, bad at something else. Einstein had no speech until age 3.
Right.
He'd be labeled autistic in a lot of school systems. Then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got very severe autism. No speech. They may have other medical problems. They may not be able to dress themselves. You can't do normal activities with them. It's such a big, broad spectrum. And the American Psychiatric Association has been changing the diagnosis manual about every 10 years. Okay, it started out as a psychological problem. Then the next DSM, they just forgot about autism. Then the next one, they said it had to be before 3 years of age and you had to have speech delay plus the social aspects and repetitive behavior. Then in the early 90s, they put in Asperger's, where you could have autism with no speech delay, where you're just socially awkward. And then the new one's coming out. They're going to take out Asperger's and make it all autism, and then they're going to take out they take the Asperger's out, call that social communication disorder, and say that's not autism. But when you really get right down to it, the social communication issues really are the core of what autism is.
Communications issues.
Yes.
Do you think that, as I was reading the book and I was thinking about this, do you think that this the way that we diagnose stuff and put everything in this DSM and they keep changing DSM, do you think autism belongs in the DSM at all?
Well, I think gradually more and more things are going to get more and more neurologically based because in my book, The Autistic Brain, we've got a whole chapter in there on the brain scans that have been done on me.
That was fascinating, yeah.
And I found out why I'm a good visual thinker. I've got a huge visual circuit. Found out why I was bad in math. My left parietal's trashed and full of spinal fluid. So that kind of wrecked that. I had a lot of anxiety problems, and my fear center was 3 times larger than normal. So it's very interesting looking at these brain scans. But I want to emphasize variability. Not everybody on the spectrum has that big visual circuit. Not everybody on the spectrum has the big amygdala. But the thing that seems to be common across it is the social communication problems, problems with face recognition, problems with picking up subtle social signals. That goes across the spectrum, especially on the higher end of the spectrum. And the thing is, there's a point where being socially awkward is just part of normal variation. When does geeks and nerds become mild autism? There's no black and white dividing line. When does feeling blue become true depression?
Right.
Again, there's no black and white dividing line. These things are a continuum. And then there's a point where you get into things that would get to be truly abnormal.
That's one of the things that struck me about some of the conclusions you were coming to, was that the spectrum and the of who we are as a people. I kept reading this book thinking the whole time I was reading it that, okay, this is about the autistic brain, but it's about all of our brains. It's about how all of us in some ways have different symptoms, different ways of behavior that can be seen as kind of not – quote-unquote normal.
Well, that's the whole idea of the neurodiversity movement.
Right.
Now, of course, if you have somebody that's nonverbal and they can't control their movements, obviously something's abnormal there. But on some of the nonverbals, in fact, in the autistic brain, we go through the profiles of 2 nonverbal people that look very low-functioning. They do a lot of abnormal movements, and they actually almost have a locked-in syndrome. They've got a good brain hidden in there. They type independently.
Right.
They are typing independently. If you don't type independently, I wouldn't use them.
Tito
Macapadahe, and he describes a sensory jumbled world where his visuals system is showing a fractured bits and pieces of things. Carly talks about how she can't control her movements. And you see, for those people, autism is a very different sort of thing. They'd like to get rid of those problems. Also, Carly is much more socially normal. And I had an old paper I wrote in the textbook years ago, an old textbook edited by Eric Schoppler, and where I took some of the books that existed years ago and I said, you get on the more severe end of the spectrum, you may almost have more normal social, but you got all these sensory problems. You get on the mild end, you know, like maybe a computer programmer or a scientist or, you know, a really good musician, and yeah, he's got the social awkwardness, but you don't have the other problems.
Right. So do you think that... This, I guess the labeling always gets to me. I mean, I kept also thinking about reading a book is that we had this idea autistic.
Well, the thing that drives me totally crazy, because I'm going back and forth between the autism community and the livestock community. Okay, then I go back home to the livestock community, and I met a rancher that's in his, probably in his early, in his mid-30s.
Mm-hmm.
He raises cattle, and he's very good at raising cattle. I know he's on the spectrum. And then how about the guy that runs the maintenance shop at one of the meat plants and another guy who takes care of the computers at a big corporation? And they're people that are 40 and up, and they have managed to get jobs and keep jobs because the social skills were pounded in. Also, when they were young, they learned work skills. And that's my final chapter in the autistic brain.
Right.
We got to teach kids work skills. And when I was 13 years old, my mother set me up a little sewing job. I did 2 afternoons a week. In a lady's house. And then when I was 15, I was cleaning horse stalls every day. There's a discipline to doing work some of these kids are not learning. That even when you have a job you love, there's a certain amount of stuff about that job that's not fun.
Right, always.
And you've got to do it. I mean, you probably have a job you love, but, you know, there's some things that you probably have to do that
are not fun.
Right.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you have to travel a lot for your job or not.
Sometimes.
Well, you like to get up at 3:30 in the morning for a 6 o'clock flight?
No.
And you've probably done that. I've done it. I hate that.
Right.
That's part of the job that's not fun.
But and I think that's just important what you were saying about the structure. And again, the spectrum. Let's talk about the spectrum. Because that's what I meant when I said autistic seems such a narrow vision.
Well, the problem is one of the other things I'm seeing is teachers. And I've talked to good teachers, and it's hard for them to shift gears from working with the classroom with the more severe kids that are nonverbal, and then you take a mild Asperger type of kid and put them in there. They don't know what to do with that kid. But they're almost like two separate groups. Now, every researcher agrees that when kids are 2 or 3 years old, if you have a child that's nonverbal, you got to start working with them. Early intervention. You got a kid that's nonverbal, you got to start working with them a lot of hours of one-to-ones. And then they kind of divide into two groups, and they kind of need different kinds of services.
Well, I was thinking about that. I was thinking about my own family.
Yeah.
My sister is brilliant. You meet my sister, she's brilliant, creative, incredible human being, not great social skills. And I bet you if you met my sister, you go, she's on the spectrum.
Probably is.
And then her daughter didn't speak until she was 6 years old. Then she couldn't stop speaking.
Well, and what's happening with the older ones, well, they learned work skills. But what I'm seeing happening today with some of the milder cases, I'm seeing kids on the spectrum, very intelligent, getting all the way through college, and they've never learned one work skill. Then when they get out on a job, good jobs, jobs they actually like, they got to do some grunt work. They go kind of, well, I don't like it. And I'm seeing too many of these smart kids becoming video game recluses because you've got to stretch these kids. Now, if they went into the video game industry, I'd be fine with that, but that's not where they're going. You've got to stretch them. And my mother had a really good instinct. She knew she couldn't just throw me like in the deep end of the pool, but she had to stretch me. And by the time I was 8 or 9 years old, I could go in stores and buy things. I could order food in restaurants. I'm seeing kids that haven't learned those basic kinds of skills like that.
And part of that it was the era, which you write about here in other books, is the era you grew up in.
Well, in the 50s, social skills were taught. You were taught to shake hands. All kids were taught this. And today's kind of looser social rules, I think it hurts the kids that are socially awkward a whole lot more. When I was 8 years old, my mother had me put on my little party dress, and I would have to shake hands with her dinner guests and serve them hors d'oeuvres. And I had to learn the right timing. I mean, I couldn't be shoving the plate in front of them every 5 seconds.
So, but that is that. So, in some senses, here's your mom, and she's very smart, but teenage mom. Wasn't really educated in the start, but understood this. There was something she understood.
Well, she kind of just had a good instinct on how much to push, because I'm seeing too many of the kids on the high end of spectrum not getting stretched. I mean, when I had my first job at 13, I talked to a mom just the other day, and I said, "Your 13-year-old needs to get a job." And she said, "Well, he's just 13. And when I was 15, I was cleaning horse stalls. I ran a horse barn when I was 15. I cleaned 8 stalls every day. I put the horses in and out of the barn. I fed the horses. I repaired the barn.
All that.
Yeah, I was doing that when I was 15, 16 years old.
But I think we don't just coddle autistic kids. We coddle all kids.
Yeah, but it's hurting.
But it's really hurting autistic kids.
It's hurting the autistic kids.
Really
more.
Hurting them.
They go, "Oh, you see, he's slow to, let's say, go up to the counter at McDonald's and order his food." Well, you take him into McDonald's when it's not busy, and you get them to go up there and order their food. And then another week you go to a Chinese restaurant or something, because you've got to do it in a lot of different places. And then you go back to the McDonald's when it's super busy. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of work your way into it. They've got to learn these things. I can remember when Mother made me go to the lumberyard. We were remodeling our kitchen. I was really good at that, but I was afraid to go to the lumberyard and talk to the clerks myself. She made me go. I got kind of upset, but I came back with the boards. I got to learn how to do those things.
So one of the things that there are some of the things in here that grab me, things that you wrote, that things like, and let's explore this for a minute. Autistic brains are not broken.
Well, especially on the mild end of the spectrum. On the very severe end of the spectrum, you've got some very serious problems. You see, this is the problem with the spectrum. Then you've got the poor mom that's got the kid that can't dress himself. And they can't do any normal activities. Something's really wrong here. But then you get on the mild end of the spectrum, some of this is just normal variation. And I have found in terms of skills for jobs, they kind of have three categories. You've got the photorealistic visual thinker like me,
mm-hmm.
who was good at art when I was, 8 years old. And that was always encouraged. And I was encouraged to do lots and lots and lots of different kind of art assignments. Couldn't do algebra. Couldn't do a higher math. Then there's the pattern thinker, the mathematical mind, who may have trouble with reading. So if this kid's a little math genius, well, then give him the harder math books to do. Then you have the guy that's a word thinker. And I'm a big believer in building the area of strength. And in the Autistic Brain book, we've got scientific research reviewed in there that shows that the object visualizer like me and the more mathematical mind are actually two different types of visual spatial thinking. And we've got scientific data and brain scan data to show that.
So, and one of the things you discovered that chapter you wrote on the MRI and when you began to explore your brain, that was just, first of all, how exciting that was for you to kind of see this exploration explode.
Well, it was very, very exciting. The first scan we ever did, we found out that it had a little abnormality in the cerebellar vermis. That wasn't particularly interesting, but I noticed the asymmetry of the ventricles. See, that actually was the parietal cortex problem with math, and the first researcher just sort of poo-pooed that off. Well, then that showed up on another scan I did in 2010, and I noticed that asymmetry on that scan, and I said, what does that mean? And then the next one I did, I found out my cerebellum was 20% smaller than normal. And that explained why I couldn't get to the expert level of skiing. I could get up to the good intermediate, but I couldn't get to where I could put them together, really close together, and do those beautiful, twisty,
right.
turns.
Right.
And I had a lot of lessons. I couldn't do it. I could get to the good intermediate stage, and that's about as far as I could get. And I found out why. And then I saw the brain scan on the visual circuit. And there was another brain scan done that showed that I was more interested in looking at pictures of things like buildings and stuff like that than I was looking at pictures of people. One of the reasons why I got interested in looking at their pictures of things is they had all this ancient old VHS tape, and I was trying to figure out where they'd gotten it from.
And what's the rest of that story?
Well, I basically found out in a functional MRI, this was at Nancy Minshew and her group at the University of Pittsburgh, found out that the functional MRI lit up more when I was looking at pictures of things and pictures of people. Well, the thing is, you need to have some people in the world interested in things.
Right.
Because who do you think invented the first stone spear? It wasn't the yak yaks around the campfire, that's for sure.
That's true. Because that's the part that I guess one of the things you're doing here in many ways, that I've just one of the reasons I fell in love with this was because you're saying to us, we have to respect all of it. It's
well,
part of our spectrum of human.
And we've got to, I'm getting worried now with all this emphasis on mathematics. Was our poor math people sort of just getting screened out? Because you need the visual thinkers like me on the scientific team. We need me on an engineering team. Because when I found out why the Fukushima nuclear power plants blew up, I couldn't believe it. I'll tell you why they blew up. They made a fatal visual thinking error, an error that I would never make. Now, I can't design a nuclear reactor. I'm going to leave that to the mathematicians. But they didn't visualize that if you put the generators that run those super important emergency pumps to keep it cool in a non-waterproof basement, when you live next to the sea, you're going to be in a pile of trouble. And the thing is, they didn't see the water coming in there. And, of course, the tsunami breached the seawall, and the basement filled up with water, and all of that emergency equipment was underwater. That's why they burned up. Diesels don't run underwater.
Not very well.
And I think anyone who's seen a truck knows that.
So one of the things, and I think that's what I'm saying, that people on the mild end of the spectrum of autism, as you describe it, in a lot of, I was talking to somebody once about this, and maybe you don't agree with this, and you might think this is crazy, but I'll ask you anyway.
All right.
A friend of mine who had an autistic nephew on an Indian reservation, in White River in Wyoming, he said he works with kids like this every day in his school over there, and he's only got 2 years worth of college, and he doesn't care. He's better than people with PhDs when he works with kids. So what he was saying to me was that the elders would say that people we would label as autistic now were just part of the spectrum of people within their community. They all had different skills. They all contributed in different ways. That everybody was different. They made up the whole.
Well, different skills, vary a lot between the people with autism. The thing that seems to be kind of universal on the milder end of the autism spectrum is uneven skills. They have a tendency to be very good at one thing and really terrible at something else. Like in my own case, I'm really good at visualization and very good at art and industrial design type of things, but I can't do algebra. And then there's some kids that can't do algebra, but they can do geometry. Then the other kind of mind is the pattern thinker, the mathematical mind who can't has difficulty with reading. And then you got the word thinker who's just kind of so-so in math and very good at memorizing lots of facts and things like this. And they have different skills, and we need to find jobs where they can use those specialized skills, like the visual thinkers like me. Industrial design, graphic design, all kinds of art things, photography things, architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mathematics mind, chemists, physicists, computer programmers, and engineers, and the word thinkers, radio journalists.
I'm a word thinker.
All kinds of journalists.
Right.
Retail sales. They're good at some sales jobs. They're good talkers about their favorite things. So some types of sales jobs they might be really good at. We got to find things for them to do that they're good at. One thing that's worrying me right now in education, with all this emphasis on math, I'm worried about a lot of smart kids getting weeded out.
Right.
An engineering design team needs a visual thinker like me to say, no, you can't put those generators at that Fukushima nuclear power plant in a non-waterproof basement. Because if it floods, the reactors are going to melt down because we won't have any emergency cooling equipment.
Right, right. And that's where you began, actually, isn't it? I mean, when you were working with animals, because you saw things others didn't.
Well, cattle and other animals are sensory-based thinkers. So I noticed when the cattle went through the chutes, there'd be a shadow, they'd stop at it. There'd be a reflection on a piece of metal, they'd stop at it. There was a rope hanging over the chute or a chain hanging down. They noticed all these little things that we didn't notice. And if you take those things out of the facility, then they walk right up the chute. And, of course, I'm always getting asked, do they know they're going to get slaughtered? I found they behave the same way in the veterinary chute as they behave in the slaughter chute. It's not going to say stress-free. It's not stress-free. But they're not going up there thinking they're going to die. They're just going up there thinking they're going to get, you know, some veterinary procedure. And, you know, they don't like getting shots. Right. You know, we don't like getting shots either.
Right, right, right. I heard you say somewhere else that when somebody asked if you ate meat, you said yes.
Yes, I do. And I've done a lot of thinking about that because half the cattle in this country in the large plants are handled in equipment I designed. Right. I got to emphasize, it's got to be managed right.
Now, you said, this is a total digression, but it has to do with what you just said and what you said earlier. You said one of the things you're interested in is agriculture.
Yes, I'm interested in agriculture. So, we do have to eat.
Yeah, yes, we do. So I'm curious what you think about that. It's just totally off your book, but we'll come right back to the book.
Okay.
But you, when you think about agriculture, and you worked in animal husbandry and worked with slaughterhouses, and
now I'm seeing when agriculture, I'm seeing crops in Arizona. Yes. And I'm starting to get pictures now of livestock things. I'm seeing. I lived in Arizona for 9 years. I'm seeing a cotton field in Arizona. I'm seeing a corn field in Illinois. I lived in Illinois for 9 years.
So what do you think about this whole argument of where agriculture, about the future of agriculture in our country? You know, not necessarily just on organic versus industrial, but that whole spectrum of thinking about where we should go.
Well, I've done a lot of thinking about it, and there's a place especially for grazing animals. Grazing animals can produce food on land that cannot be cropped. And in looking at some of these issues, we need to find out what's going out on the ground. I have traveled just about everywhere in the United States. I've been all through Western Europe, Australia. You've got the outback of Australia. The only way you can raise food there is either sheep or cattle. There's no other way. There's... It's too arid for crops. You can't get enough irrigation water. I mean, in the future, the big battles are going to be over water.
Yes, they are.
That's the real problem area. Because I was in Iowa and Nebraska, you know, during the summer. It's scary what the drought's done. I went through dead fields of corn in August. That's scary.
So what do you think? So what do you think about what our future would be there? What do you think we should be thinking about, especially when you're visualizing the present and the future, what you see, what do you think we should be thinking about doing?
Well, I think we need to be going to have to be, you know, working on the water things. I read an interesting article in the Atlantic the other day on energy. I learned about a type of energy I didn't know anything about, you know, like this methane ice stuff down in the ocean. I didn't even know about that, and that can even actually be mined.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but a lot of issues are complicated issues. Of course, you know, you take something like fracking. If you actually do it right, you might reduce methane emissions because you could burn the methane gas, but you got to burn it. You can't let it escape into the atmosphere because you're burning natural gas is better than coal. It's a real complicated thing. And one of the things that concerns me on policymakers, you've got policymakers here in D.C. that have never been out in the field. I've seen a lot of oil rigs. Go buy them all the time. And I can tell you states, the regulations have got neater looking oil rigs that probably cause less mess than states that have less regulations. I can see that driving by the oil rigs. I think we'll leave the names of the states out of it. And the problem we're getting now with the politics here is people are getting too far away from the field. It's all becoming an abstraction. You see, for me to form a concept, I look at lots of different specific examples of things. Okay, let's say you're looking at health care. Well, if we had this rule, what does this do to Joe over here? What happens to Sally over here? What happens to the lady that works at Walmart? What happens to this farmer over here? How is this going to actually affect people in the real world? And I think one of the worst things the schools ever did was taking out the hands-on classes. Hands-on classes teach you about practical reality. They also teach you how to solve problems. And the practical world is a messy world. Things don't always work out exactly right. And I'm getting really concerned with all the gridlock, and these people have forgotten they're supposed to be doing things, not just fighting.
That's true. It's true.
And we need to drag some of these people out of the beltway, and whatever they're making policy on, they need to get out in the field.
See what the real world is.
Travel's a great educator. I mean, I have, during my life, I have seen the entire United States, from cities to the farmland. And when I'm, I was on a train yesterday, and... Yeah, I look out the window. How are these people living? And I look at that.
And the way you look at it is important because you're seeing it in a different way than than word thinkers would
see.
Well,
I think things much more, you know, kind of specific examples. I mean, I have seen people that have no health care at all.
Yeah.
And they can't get their teeth fixed. Their teeth are all rotting out. I've seen that. I've seen, I talked to a lady that couldn't get a nerve problem in her arm fixed, and the nerve died and part of her arm went numb. I saw a lady that had a broken foot and couldn't afford to go to the doctor. So she put her friend's foot brace on it. That's really bad.
That's really
bad.
Okay,
these are things that are specific examples.
So come back to the imaging. Is this something of the imaging I really want to
see? As I talk about each one of those things, I am getting an image. Maybe the best way for you to figure out my visual thinking is for you to give me some keywords and pretend I'm Google for images. And I will tell you how I bring up information. But don't do something common like house or car, and don't do anything I can see in this station right now.
Okay.
I mean, don't ask me ceiling tile because I can see that. Okay.
All right. Windmills.
Well, I saw an old Dutch windmill. Then I saw a restaurant they had in Denver that used to be called the Landmark, and it had this windmill. Now I'm seeing the wind turbines. I'm seeing that big field of mountain California. Again, I am seeing specific examples of things with windmills. Then I could get off the subject. Okay, now a rail car. Now I'm seeing the train. I've gone now from windmills to train. Now, yeah. You see how I made the association there? I'm seeing the train that goes by our campus, and I'm sitting there watching all the cars go by and seeing what's in them. And now I'm on the train yesterday that I was on, so now I'm in the train file. Now I'm seeing Thomas the Tank Engine. Okay, and they're coming up as pictures. And now I'm seeing a picture book I had as a child on a little engine that could.
Right, I remember that, yeah.
Yep, but you see, and I can get in different file folders.
We have to take a very brief break, but when we come back, we'll hear more from Temple Grandin about autism and her new book, The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I'm talking with Temple Grandin. Temple Grandin is the author of many books, including the one we're talking about today, The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. She's a professor of animal science at Colorado State University and a consultant to the livestock industry on animal behavior. And that came out of her direct experience of being autistic. One of the reasons you say that people who have certain kinds of autism are the ones who design the computer programs. And
oh, those are the mathematical ones. The mathematical
right.
ones are the ones that do all the programming. I mean, Silicon Valley would never exist without a little bit of autism. In fact, those techies out there, they tend to avoid the labels like the plague. Now, where I have found that the label can help a person, an older person that's got relationship issues, their marriage is like going on the rocks. And then when the engineer finds out that he's Asperger's and then the wife reads about that, that can help them to understand each other. You see, that can be extremely helpful, giving them insight into why they're having social problems. You know, and now the thing is, in our school system, you've got to have labels to get services. And the kids on the higher end of the spectrum usually get labeled around third or fourth grade because they're getting bullied in school and they got no friends. And they're miserable in school with the bullying. I was bullied in high school. Horrible. They called me tape recorder because I always used the same phrase all the time. Just absolutely horrible. And the only places where I was not bullied was the specialized interests, things like horseback riding. Kids that were doing that were not doing the bullying. But and getting services is good, but I'm seeing them getting locked into the label and seeing too many smart kids. They're not learning any work skills. Some of these high-functioning kids are ending up on Social Security, recluses in their house. That's just absolutely terrible. And then you take the real serious, you know, nonverbal, has all kinds of serious problems. They need that Social Security check. They got to have it.
Though some of the nonverbals are very, especially the two you write about in the book, are high-functioning.
That's right. But the problem is they cannot live independently. They're like a locked-in syndrome, and they can't control the movements and things like this. So living completely independently probably would not be possible.
So when you did these MRIs and you and the take us from the story where you began your MRI work, looking at your own brain, and then you went to this high-definition fiber track.
Well, that's the latest thing.
And that was just unbelievable.
I was the first person with autism to get to do the high-definition. And that's an amazing technology because the whole center part of your brain is white matter fibers that connect up different parts of the brain. It's the inter-office connector circuits. And with older types of DTI imaging, they couldn't track out each fiber bundle because they were not able to differentiate where you have an intersection or whether you have a bridge. And this is the work of Walter Snyder at the University of
Pennsylvania. Who you're friends with now.
Oh, yeah. And we want to get this, you know, he's very interested in getting the technology out into the community. He now has got it down to a 10-minute scan, which makes it possible for insurance to pay for it. And when hospitals upgrade, and hospitals upgrading all the time, they got to get the right Siemens top-of-the-line scanner that has the right type of receivers. And then you can put the upgrade in for this the new technology. If you buy the wrong upgrade, then it's not going to work. But what this technology would enable you to do is to figure out precisely where there's a problem. Like my problem with expressive language, I couldn't get my speech out. That showed up on the scans. He took my circuit for speak what I see circuit, and I had reduced bandwidth compared to the normal control. You know, and there tends to be two kinds of speech problems in autism, expressive problems and then what's called echolalia. This is where the kid talks just fine. And he's yakking out, you know, video scripts, but he doesn't know what they mean because the meaning circuit's not hooked up. You see, and these types of technology could take autism and, like, chop it up into its component parts. Yes, and the thing that's kind of ridiculous is the technology for looking at the social problems that's been around for 10 years. Mm-hmm. That's functional MRI imaging. That's not even complicated. Where I had an ability showed up on the brain scan and where I had a deficit showed up on the brain scan. But one of the things that I could help with a little kid... Okay, let's say I got a 3-year-old that's nonverbal. You could look at that circuit and go, well, we got to really work on expressive language. Or this kid's echolalic, and this kid may turn out to be echolalic, and we got to help him learn how to learn the meaning of the language. So you're going to have to teach him differently. My speech teacher kind of just pushed me. She held up a cup and she'd say, cup. And then she'd say, cup, really slow, because I had some auditory processing problem. I didn't hear the hard consonant sounds. So she's trying to just cram, get me to say the words, get those words out. You don't have to do that to an echolalic kid. You're going to have to do a different kind of teaching so they learn the meaning of the words, starting off with labeling lots of different things.
Mm-hmm. So, you're a prime example of somebody who's able to learn, to change, to move, to grow.
Well, I see, autistic people can keep growing because, you see, I'm a bottom-up thinker. All concepts are learned with specific examples. So it's important to get these kids out doing stuff and exposed to different things because to understand something in the future, I got to compare it back to something in the past. And then another area where research is absolutely needed are these sensory problems. And these are not just limited to autism. You can get them with dyslexia,
right,
learning problems, ADHD, sound sensitivity problems, visual sensitivity problems, scratchy clothes sensitivity problems. And some of these sensory issues are so severe that they make it impossible to function in noisy restaurants or football arenas and places like that.
And you had some of those when you were young.
Sound sensitivity is now just a nuisance for me. Now, sometimes you can desensitize it by having a child initiate the sound. I was terrified of balloons popping. Well, one of the ways to help that would be to blow up a balloon really tiny, and then I pop it. Blow up a little better, a little bit bigger, I pop it. In other words, I initiate the sound and always try to push a little bit. The problem with the fluorescent lights flickering is hard to desensitize, but that can sometimes be helped with colored lenses. You try on all these different colored glasses and printing your books on different pastel papers,
mm-hmm,
putting different colored backgrounds on your tablet or your laptop, and make sure you only use three types of computers, phones, tablets, and laptops. Other types of screens flicker, but phones, laptops, and tablets, those are the good computers.
I think it's really important when you're talking about Carly Fleischman.
Yes. Yeah, she's nonverbal.
She's nonverbal. Types
independently.
And even though you're talking about neuroimaging, you're talking about stop poo-pooing self-reports and start looking at them very carefully.
Well, you see, the problem is autism is so variable. And one thing that's been a problem in studying sensory problems is one autistic person's got a visual sensitivity problem and the other one doesn't. it's not universal. The one thing on the high end of the spectrum that seems to be pretty universal are the things that show up, like the face recognition problems, some of the mirror neuron stuff, and not interested and not understanding, reacting right to facial expressions. But the other things are just so variable. And I think it's hard for normal people to understand how a sound that doesn't bother them could bother this person so bad. But these are really real problems. I have been talking about sensory issues for more than 25 years. And you probably have 100 papers on face recognition being messed up and to every one paper on sensory.
Right.
But when it comes to being able to function in the real world, the sensory problems are some of the biggest barriers. And in the Autistic Brain book, we have a lot of self-reports in there. And the self-reports that I picked out to put in there are similar to ones where I've talked to hundreds and hundreds of people. And I've had I'm finding students in my livestock handling class that cannot draw, that have a visual processing problem. And they've been helped by colored glasses. I send them out sunglass shopping. I had one lady come back and she goes, "Oh, I got an A on my economics quiz because the PowerPoint slides were no longer jiggling and I could see them."
See, I think that there are so many people like that, though.
Well, that's just it. And we see what I think, see what the imaging also, if you're going to study sensory, you can't use autism label for studying sensory. You got to find people that self-report they have this problem, put them together in a group and then go get some controls. And you've got to find people that have a sound sensitivity problem. Some have smell sensitivity problems. You've got to assign subjects to experimental groups based on what their sensory problem is. Now, I recently did a chapter for a big book on autism, a big, huge, fat book the size of a big dictionary. And I was the only one researcher in there that wrote anything about sensory problems. It would be my number one research priority because it can make doing normal activities for some people just about impossible.
When I see people, and I think people who never will be labeled autistic or Asperger's or anything else have this issue.
Oh, they do. Oh, you can have. I had a dyslexic student. She was definitely not autistic, that had very severe visual processing problems.
Yeah.
And she was very social, very nice, and horrible visual processing.
I mean, and I think that I love this thing that you Walter Schneider. He sounds like a really interesting man.
Oh, yeah, and he's a total techie. He's totally into his technology. But that's the kind of people that we need to invent things like this, and we have to thank our Defense Department for paying for this because this was developed for veterans and head injuries. And, of course, the Defense Department wants to get it out into the hospitals. And the thing that frustrates me is that those machines are going to be there, but nobody's going to know how to use them because we are going to have to in order to calibrate it, okay, at what point is a circuit bundle considered abnormal? It's all like blood pressure. Okay, at what point is the cutoff of high blood pressure? At what point is the bandwidth for the speak what I see circuit abnormal? Because they are going to be on a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to pick out the grossly abnormal things. And then I've often thought, is there such a thing as a truly normal brain?
Well, you took the words right out of my mind. That's exactly what I was going to ask. I mean, when we eat from the beginning of the book, when you talk about neurotypicals, I'm thinking, does it exist?
Well, there's a point where things obviously get abnormal. People that can't talk.
Yeah.
But there's going to be a wide range in there where I think a brain can be made more thinking, or a brain can be made more social. And I think I'm getting worried that we're going to have a lot of really good minds playing video games in the basement rather than working to solve a lot of the problems that we have.
Exactly.
And some people say, well, you're just a Luddite that's against video games. It's fine to play them for an hour a day, but what's happening is they're just doing that and nothing else, and they're not getting jobs. Now, I talked to somebody last night that worked in a technical job. I'm not going to say where he worked because I need to keep some confidentiality, but
I met him
last night. And he has got a really nice government job doing very highly technical work. He says, I got a good boss that understands me. That's a person that's doing some technical work, scientific type of work, that's very, very important. But then what worries me is then the junior edition of that guy comes along, and he's 18 years old, and he's playing video games in the basement instead of getting an important scientific technical job.
Right, right.
And he's got a good boss that understands him.
So how do we – so what do you – so you, in the end of the book, you talk a lot about this, but I mean, how we change this?
What we got to do is develop strengths. Okay, when you're a weird geek, how do you sell yourself? When I first started out, I sold myself by showing my portfolio. And my first portfolio was sign painting. In fact, I painted signs at the carnival at the Arizona State Fair. And I sold it by showing my portfolio. And then I started writing for the Farmer Ranchman. You know, start out one little article at a time. And then when I started out designing cattle handling facilities, it was one little job at a time. Then I put them in my portfolio. And I showed people my drawings. They thought it was weird, but when I whipped out one of my drawings, and the Autistic Brain Book's got some nice drawings. And
yes, it does.
Done,
yeah.
And people go, oh, wow, you did that? People respect ability. So when you're a weird geek, you need to show off your work. And don't put too much junk in your portfolio. Put four or five of your best things in there. Okay, if it's artwork, it's artwork. If it's drawings, or let's say if you're a mathematician, it might be math formulas you did, computer programming you did, some chemistry thing you did. You want it so that when someone looks at it, they go, wow. And if you're a word person, there's some writing that you've done. And you show off your portfolio. You sell your work rather than yourself. And for lots of times, you've got to find the back doors into work. I just talked to somebody up in New York where this autistic kid in his early 20s, he's got a great job at one of the movie theaters running all the electronic projectors. Well, his brother worked there, got him in there, started out as an usher. Then he learned how to work the projectors. We've got to find these back doors into things. You know, a lot of companies now, it's all this, you know, interview online and stuff. You got to short circuit that stuff. You got to network.
Right.
And the thing I learned a long time ago is you never know where you're going to find the person that can open up the door. So you better have your portfolio on your phone.
Now on your phone. So you can have it on your phone now.
You can have it on your phone. I had to have it in a little black notebook.
So this is the person you had in your book before, Jesse.
Okay, now I've had to keep confidentiality. Some of these names, we keep changing them for keep confidentiality.
Yeah.
What did Jesse?
This is the book her mother wrote, Exiting Nirvana, A Daughter's Life with Autism.
Oh, Jesse Park. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That one.
Okay, Jesse Park. And I have met Jesse Park, and she appears, you know, like in the moderate range, does beautiful artwork. And she was taught how to work, and she's still working in the post office at the university, sorting the mail. And she had to learn that she couldn't, like, read everybody's mail addresses before she put them in the mailbox. Because that was kind of violating privacy. But, you know, she was taught work skills young. You know, she knows how to cook and clean and do a whole lot of things. And she's the pattern thinker. She's Raven's progressive matrices. But she's much more moderate. And is going to have to live in a semi-supervised situation. Her parents are dead now, but now the other family members are enabling her to stay in the house, and they'll have students living in the house with her. And she's very good at cooking and cleaning.
And
she sees in colors. Like, she'll draw a drawing similar to what I draw, you know, like kind of drafting. Like, draw a drawing of a bridge. And then she'll put, like, psychedelic colors on that bridge. And unfortunately, the book doesn't, you know, really,
yes, black and white
doesn't give justice to pictures. But you can go on the Google Pictures and type in Jesse Park's art.
Which I did after I saw the book. Unbelievable.
It's absolutely beautiful. And she's selling her art professionally. Now, of course, she's got to have somebody to help her with the business, because I'd put her in the moderate range. But great talent. There's another guy named the Eco Artist. And he does work with ripped up paper. And he's now selling art professionally. Started out just originally in the art shows. And I said to his mom, I said, this stuff's good. Why don't you enter it in a Houston art show? And they did. And he got it in there. It's absolutely beautiful. But abilities have to be developed. And both of those are more moderate. They're going to have to live in at least a semi-sheltered situation. But then they get, you know, satisfaction, and they get recognition for doing beautiful art.
So do you think...
And you've got to make sure that the people they're living with don't take advantage of them. We've got to have good safeguards against that.
Right. And you write about a lot of high-functioning autistic people that
you know.
But
Jessie's somebody that if she hadn't been really, 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 really worked with, she would have just been sitting in the corner doing nothing.
She'd been lost.
Yeah, she would have just been lost.
And so the numbers of people diagnosed with autism, as we know, have just exponentially exploded.
We talk a lot about that. in the autistic brain.
Yes.
And I think the mild cases is increased detection. Because I work in a technical field. I go out to meet plant. Oh, the maintenance shop? Well, the plant would fall down if they didn't have the ass piece down in the maintenance shop. And there are guys all over 40. They're all undiagnosed. So a lot of that's increased detection. I think there is some severe autism that has increased. We've got older parents, and especially with dads, you get genetic copying mistakes. Because to make sperm every few days, you got to make a copy of a copy of a copy, and you're always copying the copy of the copy.
Mm-hmm.
So that introduces mistakes. There's more environmental contaminants. There's a lot of pharmaceuticals getting dumped into the fetus, and you also have to be it's not just the first trimester to worry about. You got to worry about the few months beforehand because that gets dumped all over the ova. There's been some autism clusters around things like oil refineries, plastics factory. Also, you get all the techies together. Of course, they're gonna form relationships and have kids. And when you kind of concentrate that genetics, you're more likely to get somebody that's severe. Because I have found hits on my website. The tech centers mm-hmm. hit up a lot on it.
That's interesting. I mean, is there actually?
I can look at the cities and I go, yeah, that's Microsoft. That's Apple. That's Texas Instruments. That's because the cities. I can't track users. We don't track.
Right.
I can only track domain names. No, because I don't make anybody log on. I go, oh, Boeing.com? Interesting. Yeah, but you see, but that's tech.
Right.
But the thing is, we need to have these people because you wouldn't even have airplanes otherwise.
Without it, absolutely.
That's right. And there's a lot of artists. Van Gogh. I profiled Van Gogh in Thinking in Pictures, and I got all his biographies on him, and he was an odd little boy.
Yes, he was.
Yep.
Probably autistic at some level.
Probably.
In the spectrum.
Probably somewhere on the spectrum.
See, I think the more I read the book, I kept thinking, I think there are a lot more people on the spectrum than we even know.
Well, you see, it's a continuum. One is a little less social, becomes something that's abnormal. And I think the other thing's a problem is today we don't teach social rules the same way they were taught in the 50s. In the 50s, all kids were taught how to shake hands. You were taught table manners. When kids had bad table manners, it was corrected. If you stood too close to somebody, they corrected you. And the thing is, you don't scream no. You give the instruction. Like, for example, if I spun my fork around, mother would say, put it back on your plate. And I remember one time when I was in around third or fourth grade at the school cafeteria, they served the ice cream. And I leaned over and lapped it like a dog. And they took it away and they said, you're not a dog. And I never did that again. You know, manners were just taught. And that's the way it was with all the kids. And if you went over to another kid's house, the rules were the same. And the social skills much more systematically taught. You see, and that helped the kids that were mildly autistic.
I've learned so much doing that. I think that one of the brain thing I really would like to learn more about, as you wrote about here, because I think that you write about the brain. You also write about this woman's work was amazing, and we should talk about what we learned from her, Michelle Dawson.
Yes. Well, and she's doing research and finding that the people with autism are really good on a test called the Raven's Progressive Matrices, which is a pure pattern thinking test. And they don't do so well in the Wechsler, where you've got other verbal sorts of things. It's a different kind of thinking. And this rears get a person with autism doing the research.
She's autistic
That's
as well.
Right. That's right. And you see, the way the autistic person is going to approach research is bottom up. You know, instead of making a grand hypothesis and try to find the data that cram into it, you try different things. And then the one thing that the other people working with her said is that she never sort of overstepped the bounds and made a bigger claim for the data than what you could really justify. But we need these kind of people. I went into a fabulous fish lab. Oh, absolutely fabulous. It was in a big warehouse of a room, and I could tell that they built all this stuff from Home Depot and the local farm store. And it was fabulous. And I went to the scientist. I said, who built this? It was the maintenance man.
Mm-hmm.
But you need that kind of mind. And I'm getting worried about all this emphasis on math now screening these people out. Where there's one state now that if I want to become an auto mechanic, I got to take calculus to become an auto mechanic?
Ridiculous.
That's ridiculous. See, we need to recognize there's different kinds of minds. If I want to be a chemist, I'm going to have to do algebra. That field requires it. But and we're getting into a molecular biology and genetics things requiring more math. But you still need the visual thinker to do the equivalent of don't put those generators in that Fukushima nuclear power plant in that non-waterproof basement.
So there's one thing you raised in here a little bit about people, whether they would not choose not to be who they are.
Well, I get asked all the time, if I could snap my fingers, would I want to not be autistic? No, I don't want to change. It is autism's what I am. I like the logical way I think. But on the other hand, my career and being a professor comes first. And autism comes second. I'm getting very concerned when 9-year-olds walk up to me and they go, oh, I want to tell you all about my autism. I want to hear about a 9-year-old's science project. Or he loves to train dogs. Or he likes poetry or history or something. You know, autistic kids get fixated on things. I got fixated on cattle chutes that helped make my career. I got fixated on optical illusion rooms. But I get concerned where the kid's fixation is totally just autism.
On the alleged disorder.
I have sciatic nerve problems. Well, I don't walk up to people and say, well, I'm a sciatic. Yes, and I found good exercises on YouTube for it. Yeah, and I do like to tell people about them. But that's secondary to other things that I do.
So tell me what comes next. I'm curious what comes next in terms of where you've...
Well, I'm doing a lot of talks, and I hope I also like to talk to educators because I get worried about screening out, especially my kind of mind. You know, we're getting all this emphasis on STEM. And the STEM programs for elementary school kids are great because they're putting back all the hands-on things.
Right.
But then you hit the algebra wall. But we need to recognize that my kind of mind is still needed. We need the different kinds of minds.
Thumble Grand, this has been a joy for me to make this journey to DC to meet you.
Well, it's great to be with you today.
I really enjoyed this. The autistic brain has opened my mind to many things, and this is just the beginning of the exploration. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We have to take a very brief break, but when we come back, we have a new episode of Soundbites where we'll ask different environmentalists, farmers, and public officials how environmental and agricultural legislation affects the economic and ecological health of Delmarva.